I guess as a means of background, efforts to end segregation practices in Atlanta had begun in earnest in the late 1950s. And I guess the catalyst for the Atlanta effort, for at least for the student movement, would have been the Greensboro sit-in in North Carolina.
Right. On February 1st, 1960, students in Greensboro, North Carolina, sat in all day at a segregated lunch counter and launched this wave of sit-ins that spread like wildfire across the South, including to Atlanta. In Atlanta, students like Julian Bond at Morehouse College, Lonnie King at Morehouse College, noted what had happened in Greensboro and said, let's do this here, this new kind of radical, confrontational sort of tactic. In Atlanta, the student movement was distinguished by the fact that eventually they took out an advertisement in the Atlanta Constitution and the New York Times called An Appeal to Human Rights, listing a long litany of injustices and inequalities and indicating that from the outset this was about much more than getting a cup of coffee. And so that was one thing that distinguished the Atlanta movement. And then they began to engage in other kinds of sit-in activities and other kinds of protests throughout the spring of 1960.
From the very beginning, what the student movement was agreeing on was that all protests would be nonviolent.
Correct. I mean, this was sort of the basic tenet that, you know, in not only in Atlanta but in Nashville and other places, this kind of adherence to nonviolence for a variety of reasons. First of all, that it was more effective, that you contrasted well with your opponents. If you engaged in violent activity, you know, at that time, you were at much greater physical risk and personal risk and so forth.
It seems to me, from what I've read about it, that the student movement in Atlanta was very well thought out, very well planned, very well organized.
Yeah, it's one of the more organized of any movement in any community. You could argue that Nashville and Atlanta were the two most organized student movements. They coordinated with the different colleges. They very carefully figured out their targets that they were going to sit in at. They crafted this appeal to human rights, which was published in the Constitution and the New York Times. It was very well coordinated and organized.
So at the very beginning, you're talking maybe a handful of students at Morehouse.
And other places, Spelman certainly.
And Spelman.
Mm-hmm.
One event after another, more and more students are getting involved.
That's right.
The movement is really growing.
The movement is growing both locally and across the South. By April 1960, a new organization, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had been organized in Raleigh, North Carolina, and shortly after that moved its headquarters to Atlanta. Certainly more and more students are getting involved in different kinds of activities as the movement evolves in these months of 1960.
So by this day in May of 1960, you've got, I'm guessing, the largest demonstration in the history of the city to that point.
There is a planned march to move from the Atlanta University Center to the Georgia State Capitol on May 17, 1960, which is the sixth anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision outlawing school desegregation. Of course, most of the schools, including schools here, were still very much segregated 6 years after that decision. And you have about 1,400, 1,500 students, which, if you think about it, was an incredibly high percentage of all the students at the Atlanta University Center at that time. I don't know the exact number, but certainly a significant percentage of the entire student body of all the six affiliated universities there, marching silently, well-dressed, down to the state capitol.
What's the local reaction?
I mean, people are sort of shocked as the march goes through the streets of Atlanta. I mean, they've never seen anything like this. It certainly was the most significant and the largest with an overwhelmingly black population ever. There's no doubt about that. And Governor Vandiver had ordered state troopers around the state capitol, and white residents had been allowed onto the Capitol grounds, while black residents were not allowed onto the Capitol grounds. And so there was a large group of what you might call toughs who had lined the Capitol grounds in anticipation of this march reaching the Capitol.
But the march is successful.
Certainly, in terms of sheer numbers, it's successful. You avoid a bloodbath, in part because of the intervention of Atlanta Police Chief Herbert Jenkins. Jenkins is a very interesting guy, and he's very much part of this more moderate Atlanta leadership. Jenkins meets with some of the student leaders in his police car as they're kind of marching toward the Capitol and suggests that they take an alternate route that actually bypasses the Capitol per se, lest a bloodbath occur. And I think he's probably played an important part in staving off a really violent confrontation right on the steps of the Capitol. They do eventually instead go to the Wheat Street Baptist Church on Auburn Avenue, where they're met by the Reverend William Holmes Borders of that church, and also the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., you know, who kind of greet the students and hail them for what they've done.
So this energizes the student movement in Atlanta. There's no turning back after that. And within a year, the Atlanta Public Schools are desegregated.
Well, and some of the downtown facilities are desegregated as well.
Well, Cliff Kuhn, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.